time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for March 23rd, 2019. It's time to set aside all those political tweets, stories, memes, and posts, and enjoy an hour of cycling tales from near and far. We begin this evening's show with the Boob Ride. All right, stifle those giggles for a second. This event is a very different animal from the usual raise money for a cause ride. Keeping it local, Jennifer Carey and Paul Self run the two locations of the Boob Ride to raise money for the last mile of breast cancer treatment. Partnering with local social workers, all the registration fees from the Boob Ride are given to cancer patients who might need anything from a ride to treatment, a cart of groceries, or a mortgage payment, taking those daily burdens off of the patient's shoulders so that she can go through the healing process. We'll fill in the details with Jennifer and Paul in a moment. After a break, we'll speak with Phil Deeker, the founder of the Sankol Challenges. Once again, not your ordinary events, Phil began the challenges when he turned 50 as a way to celebrate, which is going to sound very unlikely as a celebration when he tells you about it. And finally, Gary McKeaton, who is the voice you hear when the Outspoken Cyclist opens and closes each week, reviews a new book that will be on the stands April 2nd. Nige Tassel's 3 Weeks, 8 Seconds, Greg LeMond, and Laurent Fignon, and the Epic Tour of 1989 is an in-depth look at not only the historic race, but it also explores some of the travails that LeMond went through to get back into the peloton after being shot in the back by his brother-in-law and suffering a severe appendicitis attack. So it's off to California, where I caught up with Jennifer Carey and Paul Self in the midst of the preparations for this year's Boob Ride. Hello, Jennifer and Paul. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having us.
It is my pleasure.
Thank you, Diane.
Of course. So the title of your event was enough to make me curious. I got an email and it said the Boob Ride, and I'm like, yeah, I'm in. I don't know which of you, Paul or Jennifer, is going to tell me about the ride and how it came to be, but then we'll talk about the roles that you play. So give us some background on how this event started and when.
So I'll start off, Diane. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2008. And so this really motivated me into wanting to get involved in awareness and start raising money and, you know, to actually do something to help other people who were going through the same thing. So I signed up to do the 3-day 60-mile walk with Susan G. Komen. And in order to participate, you have to raise $2,300. And so the first year that I did the walk, it was easy fundraising. My mom had just been diagnosed and all her friends were donating. And then the second year, it was crickets. So I reached out to Paul, who was my boss at the time and an avid cyclist. And I asked him if he would be game to put together a little ride and to help me raise money for breast cancer. So we put together this fundraising ride and I got all my family to volunteer. We rode from Irvine to Solana Beach, and my dad put all the bikes on the truck and trucked them back up to Orange County for us. And so we called it, well, Paul came up with a name of Biking for Boobs. And at the time, we had about 30 riders, and we raised about $800. Oddly enough, somebody had a trademark on Biking for Boobs. So we were trying to make it a PC name and something like Orange County Cancer Awareness Ride and all of these things. And one of our avid supporters had won multiple awards in our ride, and he said, nope, you guys are the Boob Ride. So we ran with it and trademarked it. So now we're the Boob Ride.
And by the way, I don't think it's at all offensive. I think it's very descriptive. And I think anybody who hears it, who rides a bike, gets it instantly. So not a problem at all.
Yes.
So Paul, tell me your role in all of this.
The joke is that I'm the token man on the team.
That works.
I am the only man on the team, but I'm the cyclist that lays out the routes, understands the mentality of the riders and what they're after, ranging from the short riders to the long riders. You know, my real business is marketing. And so the Boob Ride and playing off of the shock value of that to get people to go, wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. And pushing the envelope. So, you know, we built awards around all that. We've got these parodies going along. And so my role has many facets between operations, building the back office, the websites, the e-commerce, and handling all of those things and getting it all squared away. And, you know, you made the comment about you don't find the name offensive, but we don't feel like we've really done enough marketing until somebody sends us an email complaining that our name is offensive.
That's true.
We get at least one or two emails that somebody says, that is so offensive. And we just don't even respond anymore. We're like, okay, good. We've done enough marketing. We've hit that threshold.
Yes. You say, yes, that's awesome that somebody's actually paying attention. I get that. I totally get that. So let's stay in keeping with the idea of boobs, breasts, of course, and the motto, funding the last mile of breast cancer treatment. So this is a little different from what we think of for fundraising for breast cancer. Explain what you mean by funding the last mile.
You know, originally we had donated much of our money to the Susan G. Komen charity, and they fund community awareness and treatment and research. And as we went along in the ride, and as it grew, we were talking to our supporters, and they really liked the idea of keeping their money local. They register for the ride, 100% of their registration fees go to the cause. We're a 100% volunteer organization. So it's very different. It's a tax deductible receipt that they get once they register for the ride. Also, I had a good friend who's one of our Yellow Bra sponsors, and he lost his sister to cancer, and she was financially tight and couldn't afford to get to treatment except for taking a city bus in Chicago. So if you can imagine having a compromised immune system and putting on your little surgical mask and getting on a city bus and changing buses to get to actually chemo and radiation, it's pretty brutal. So we wanted to step in and fill in those gaps that other charities and organizations are missing. So we wanted to fund things like transportation to treatment, meal prep, house cleaning, and pay the bills, so that the patients can focus on healing in that last mile of their treatment. So we developed relationships with local social workers, and they identify and authenticate people in need, and then we start paying directly for the treatment, for the groceries, you know, the mortgage, and other little things that will just get them through that last mile so they can focus on healing.
That's really impressive. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Paul Self and Jennifer Carey. The ride is called the Boob Ride, but more importantly, it does something very different from just handing money over to an organization for research. It actually deals with the people on the ground. And I really, really appreciate that. Not having had to go through this, but knowing a lot of people who have, I can't imagine what that's like. Who administers that fund? How is that money doled out?
So our relationships with the social workers allow us to then say, okay, we've got somebody that's identified, and as a nonprofit, we cannot legally just give an individual cash. And if you do so, it's fraught with peril, and there's too much scams or too many things. So having the social workers that identify them and authenticate them and say, this is a valid need, then we can buy grocery gift cards from the local grocery stores and give them those gift cards. So we're buying it from Ralph's in this case, and then delivering those to those people in need. We can coordinate with Uber or Lyft, or we can pay the mortgage, but we can't give the individual the cash. And we've got relationships to handle all of those details on the ground and make sure that there's not fraud involved. And one of the things that we also heard from our, and I think Jennifer said this, was that our supporters want us to stay local. So all the money stays within about a 15-mile radius of the event. So we have an event in San Diego and one in Irvine. And so we keep all that money very local. And our supporters love the fact that we are doing local good and nothing leaves the area.
Have people come to you and said, we want to replicate your ride? We'd like to know what you're doing, how you're doing it, and how we can set it up.
Yes, actually, we've had a lot of interest from different organizations, you know, from anywhere from, you know, charities to other big athletic events. And they want us to institute some sort of fundraising model and that the participants would need to fundraise like other events. And that's something that we've entertained, but for now, our cyclists, they really like the fact that they pay their money, they do the ride, they challenge themselves, and at the end, they have a big party, and there's a lot of camaraderie, and they vote for each other for the bra awards and, you know, things like that. Paul, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, you know, we've explored scaling up. We've actually got a financial model to scale a lot bigger. We need the financial resources and the team to do that. And since we're an all-volunteer organization right now, the ability to go into other areas, manage those areas, make sure the brand is authentic, manage the non-fraud delivery of funds in the right areas, you know, we'd love to do that, but we need resources to scale all that up. But we're just not ready yet. We've tested it in a couple of spots, and we're just spread too thin to manage that. We'd have to quit our day jobs and earn a living at it. And right now, the nonprofit's not in a position that they could bring us on the payroll like that.
We like the idea that 100% of the registration fees goes to the cause, and then we get corporate sponsorships and private donors to help us with the operational costs, the insurance and permitting and like that. And so really finding a model that sustains that is important to us. And so other organizations, you know, they may give 78% to the cause and keep some from the overhead or for the operations. It's really just trying to find a good fit that we can keep our model and the fact that 100% of what you sign up for goes to the patients in need.
How much money have you raised so far?
We're in our 10th year anniversary, and we're a little above $105,000 over those 10 years. Last year, we peaked out at $30,000, so we had a really great year last year. It was about 2 years ago that we did the transition from, or started the transition from Susan G. Komen to funding local. And so we're seeing more growth now that we've shifted that focus. So I'm pretty happy with where the growth numbers have gone to.
Let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of the ride. So I know there are two routes. There are two start locations. How are you two splitting up that time and energy to run two separate rides?
So we have additional three board members. So Marianne Masterson is the ride director, and she directs the San Diego ride. And there's actually three routes in San Diego. There's a 30, 60, and a 90-mile route. The 30 is for people who are big on heart and little on training. And, you know, these are the riders that wear tutus and they dress up and they just have a great time. And it's straight up the coast. And it starts in Solana Beach and it ends in Solana Beach. And so there's also a 60 and a 90-mile route. And then the Orange County, which was the original location of the ride or the start, they ride from, Irvine train station down to Solana Beach. And the straight shot is the 60-mile route, which takes the coast all the way down. And then there's a 90-mile route that turns inland and goes up through something called the Elfin Forest, which sounds magical. And it's more painful, I think, the elevation. And it's a strenuous ride. But it's beautiful, and so Paul is the mastermind behind planning the rides and putting out the route arrows and all of those things. So we have two events. Orange County has two rides to choose from, and the San Diego ride has three rides to choose from.
If I can add to that, You know, we started in Orange County only. And so we will take, like this last year, we had 200 people in Orange County and they go down to Solana Beach. And then we put 200 bikes on trucks and bring them back. And we put those 200 people on buses and bring them back.
Got it.
So a couple of years into the event, we go, what if we had a secondary start in Solana Beach so we wouldn't have to bring those people home? And so we added that event, and we luckily brought Marianne on it. And Jennifer's talking about the 30 mile and the 60 mile and the 90 mile. We call those rides, the A cup route is 30 mile, and the C cup route is the 60 mile, and the D cup route is the 90 mile. And so we play with the boob ride and the bra thing all the way through all the rides. And everybody talks about I'm doing the D cup ride, which is a really, really hard ride. And it's ridden at race pace because that's the only way you can win the yellow bra, which is for the first one in, is on the D cup ride. And that's a full throttle hard race in contrast to the A cup where they're wearing tutus and wings and guys are wearing bras. And it's such a very different ride between the two.
I love it. I think it's awesome. I really like the idea of guys wearing bras. Maybe they'll figure out how uncomfortable they really are. Well, that's a different story. Anyway.
So on that note, in San Diego, we've got these guys that support us a lot, and they raise a lot of money for breast cancer because their wives were affected by it, and they're called the Melon Men, and they show up on the ride with watermelons in bras. They're inflated watermelons, but they do the entire ride wearing bras, and they're doing the 60-mile ride, and these guys do fantastic stuff.
It sounds just fascinating and fabulous. It's sort of like, what is that run in San Diego where everybody gets all dressed up? There's a funny run, or not San Diego, up in San Francisco. There's some sort of a crazy run up there that people dress up for.
Beta Breakers. I've done that.
Yes, it is. Beta Breakers. That's it. Anyway, so the last thing I want to talk about is when are the rides and how can people find out more about them?
So our ride this year is Saturday, April 13th in both locations. Riders can sign up for the Orange County event or the San Diego event on our webpage, which is theboobride.org. And there's a sign up and registration page right there.
And the website's excellent. It's very easy to navigate and it looks like a lot of fun. I think you're doing some great work and I'm sure that the people who are able to take advantage of the charity that you're offering them are probably eternally grateful because I can't imagine some of the things these women have to go through. So good for you. Big rah-rah. And I'm really, really happy to have talked with you about it. Once again, we've been talking with Paul Self and Jennifer Carey. They are the ride directors of the Boob Ride, one in San Diego, one in Orange County. It's theboobride.org. Good luck, April 13th. And, we'll check the website and see what it looks like after this ride.
That sounds great. Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you for talking with me. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Jennifer Carey and Paul Self are the ride directors for the annual Boob Ride in California. If you're interested in learning more or registering for either the Orange County or San Diego start location, you can log on to boobride.org. Get your tutu ready. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, it's off to Belgium to speak with Phil Deeker. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. A few weeks ago, we talked with Brad Sauber, who had just announced his new company, Raid Cycling. At the time, I thought that his destinations and the difficulty of riding them sounded really daunting. Brad, in turn, introduced me to Phil Deeker, and after learning about his work, I have a whole new appreciation and respect for those of you who rise to these challenges. Here's my conversation with Phil. Hi, Phil. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I guess we have a mutual friend, although I have not met Brad. I certainly had a wonderful conversation with him, and he decided that I needed to talk with you. So here we are, right?
Yeah, I met Brad a few years ago. They're putting on several trips together. So he kind of knows a little bit about what I do.
And what you do is pretty remarkable, and that's why we want to talk to you today. So tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, when you became a cyclist, and then we will talk about Sunk.
Yeah, okay. It bemuses quite a lot of people, the fact that I came to cycling sort of seriously, let's say, when I was only 40, 61 now. And so kind of been making up for it ever since, really. You know, I was always I'm an outdoor person for sure. I really love the outdoors. That's where I feel best. And I was always kind of sporty, but to be honest, I just had a bike as a kind of, like any kid has a bike. So I got into it a bit like many kind of sort of 40-year-olds do. It wasn't a crisis thing. It was a change of job. And for the first time in my life, I found myself indoors most of the time. And to kind of balance things out, keep things in harmony, I found a way of doing that, which was cycling to work. And so literally I started, you know, in jeans and sweaty clothes that were not definitely, that had nothing to do with Lycra. And I got hooked. And I think because I now do a job that the kind of role that is often held by ex-pros or guys who at least tried to make a living of it in their best years physically, I guess I have a different way of relating to people because I actually came into the sport in a way that is probably closer to the way my clients are. In other words, I don't have a lot of retired racers either. I have people who discovered cycling, who love to push themselves a bit. And I can relate to that so well because it was hard for me to come into a sport at a relatively late time in life, although I don't think it's ever too late to start cycling.
No, I would agree. What were you doing before that you were outside that then you had to come inside?
Yeah. So I've done various things. I've grown vegetables, worked on a big organic vegetable farm. I've managed a herd of goats and made goat cheese. I've built three houses for myself and my family. And for the 10 years prior to taking on cycling as full time, I was a pyrotechnician. I was putting on big scale pyrotechnic displays all over the world, and that actually, as grand as that seems, it involves 90% of the time is in front of a screen at a desk and making phone calls and all that.
Yeah, but it sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds creative.
It was, interestingly enough, it was handling explosives is less dangerous than cycling, I discovered.
I can believe that.
the most interesting thing is that in a funny way, it's funny always how sort of life, the path of life reveals itself. It was actually the perfect training for running the trips that I run now because I learned how to deal with, analyze situations from a health and safety point of view, deal with changing goalposts all the time, and probably more than anything, learn how to manage a team of people and keep everyone, smiling when maybe things aren't that great, when it's been raining all day or whatever it might be. And that, I think, was an amazing building stone for doing what I'm doing now, strangely enough.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Phil Deeker. He is in Belgium. And he runs a very unusual and special organization. It's the Sankt Kol Challenge. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But on your 60th birthday, you did something very special. And now you're 61. What did you do last year?
Yeah. I rode 1,000 Kols. So it was actually in 2017, which was 10 years after I rode my first kind of personal challenge, which was to ride 300 cols, 300 mountain passes, which I did in 26 days. And that was a way of celebrating my 50th birthday, having, as I just briefly referred to, having got hooked really over 10 years of commuting and then that becoming, you know, basically an obsession. And that was the birth of the events called the Song Coles Challenges, which started 2 years after in 2009. And as I saw another kind of time landmark approaching my life, I thought this is another opportunity to do something very selfish, particularly thinking about my wife, because it meant 5 months away from home, and also to celebrate the sort of the symbolic 10th year of the kind of the conception of the Song Coles Challenge. And so I decided to put together 10 events, pretty much back to back, with the idea that this time I would really concentrate on just riding them and do something that I didn't set out to kind of for the sake of the achievement itself. It was more to deal with the thing that a lot of, I guess, any kind of extreme or adventure sports person has, which is the sort of, so what's next thing, you know, where you do something and then suddenly you've got to find something harder. And I wanted to do something that was so hard that actually I wouldn't even ask that question anymore. And it's worked after 5 months of cycling up and down mountains. But more, also more specifically, what didn't quite work in the plan was that I hoped to find someone to actually run the events for me, a guy who would manage, or guy or a girl who would manage each event. And that I would just shadow, really, just making sure that things were going as they should, so that I could get a bit more sleep than I usually do on events and just, to say, focus on the physical challenge. That didn't work, and so I ended up running the events as well. So that was quite tough because essentially I spent 5 months with in between 4 and 5 hours sleep every night. And once one event was finished, we usually had 3 days before the next one, which meant 1 day of driving, 1 day of shopping, and 1 day of welcoming the next group of riders. And so it went on, starting late May, finishing early October.
How many people went along with you?
In all, we had about 190 over those trips. So, you know, an average of sort of just under 20 per trip. I think, yeah, it's sort of panned out. Some trips had a little bit less and some a little bit more.
So altogether, you rode 1,000 passes in those 5 months.
Yeah.
How many miles a day are we talking, or kilometers?
The average is 200 kilometers a day. And so, you know, so that in itself, we're around the 20,000 kilometer mark. And vertical meters was roughly about, well, I'm going to talk in meters again. I'm not
That's
very
okay.
good.
That's okay. We can deal in meters.
About 4,500 meters. So 4,500 to 5,000 meters. Biggest day was 6,500 meters. In fact, just nearly 7,000. So that's, yeah, it's quite a lot.
I want to ask you a little bit about your equipment. What are you riding?
So I've always been riding, actually, you'll like this one. I've been riding an American bike, a Parley.
Oh, so you're riding a carbon bike. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've had a good relationship with them and I've just found their bikes so comfortable because, you know, one might think, oh, you've got to ride a tie frame for that sort of riding or steel or, and I just found their frames, the lightness obviously of carbon, but without the stiffness that some frames have. So yeah, I did actually for that year, I rode with DI2 and disc brakes. And really, I'm glad I did because particularly the disc brakes gave me that reassurance and the reliability, you know, come rain or shine, I had the same response. Because as I went on, I was fine most of the time. But as I went on, particularly towards the end, I had a real problem with concentration. I was just getting so tired due to lack of sleep, really. And so to have just a quick click with the DI2 and the reliability of disc braking was actually quite essential. I only managed to have a little tumble once, which didn't even lose me much skin. It was just a silly error with a bit of loose gravel. So I was extraordinarily lucky because, funnily enough, when I thought about the challenge before, the thing that I was wary of and apprehensive of most of all was the idea of actually I was going to have to stop. because I knew I had only one-off opportunity in my life to do this. It's so much planning. I planned it for well over 6 months that I knew I couldn't realign everything to make this happen again. And so there were quite a few times when destiny really proved to me that actually it was going to agree to me doing this. You know, I've got lots of little anecdotes. But the one thing that I was particularly worried about, obviously, was an error, making an error, or just bad luck on a descent, because we talk about climbing.
Sure.
But that also means that I descended for 20,000 kilometers.
Sure. Exactly. Right. Well, yeah. Let me ask a question about the people who went along with you. So you'd pick mm-hmm. up a different group every however often. How are they finding out about this amazing challenge? And how are they finding out about it even now? I mean, all of your challenges except one, the last time I looked, are closed already for 2019.
There's actually a few places left on two of them. It's a good question. Up until this year, I benefited from the support of Rafa. You know the name, I presume.
Yeah.
I actually had a long friendship with Simon Mottram, who's the CEO still there. And he was the one who supported the crazy idea I took to him way back in 2007. So I obviously gained quite a lot of exposure through them. Because Simon, the owner, always wanted my events to be kind of like the cherry on top of his cake, to which all riders would aspire to do one day, which was very nice. But now they've had to close their travel section.
I know. That's sad.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It was a good thing happening there. And so I'm now running it on my own. But I manage the events on my own anyway within the sort of it was more like a kind of a freelancer within their network, and they just let me get on with everything. The fact is that I actually have about, I'd say, 70% return rate. So it means that on any event, there's at least 2/3 of the riders are riders who've already done one and who are coming back. And that's, I think that's quite, that's very, very good news for me. But it's also, one would think, quite surprising.
It's remarkable.
Yeah. The thing we were most afraid of with Simon Mottram at the beginning was he said, look, this is ridiculous, but we love it. It's crazy. He said, I can see that happening for 1 year. But, you know, those guys, they'll never come back. They'll never want to see you again. And who knows how many will finish? And so, you know, when we did the first one, we had 30 riders, and I was pretty apprehensive because, you know, if there are only 10 or 5 or 10 of those 30 who finish it, then that means I got 20 guys going back to their friends saying, you know, don't even think about it. It's just ridiculous. Whereas actually, even on that first one, I probably had about a 80% success rate. So that means that 20% of the guys would not have completed it all. So there are always shortcuts to take on stages, or they decide to have a day off and ride in one of the support vehicles. But they'll all be riding and they'll all have had a great 10 days, you know, on the bike most of the time.
Philip, can you hang with me a second? We need to take a break and then we'll be right back, okay?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Hang on. So we're speaking with Philip Dieker. We are going to take a real quick break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Phil Dieker. He runs an organization called the St. Col Challenges. It's fascinating. It's something I couldn't do in a million years. And we were talking about the return rate of people who do one of these events. They're very difficult. And then they come back and do them again. And one of the things you say, and I watched this wonderful video on your website, one of the things that you say is that it changes people, that people literally at the end of one of your events are like life changes.
Yeah,
What happens?
Yeah, I know. It sounds like almost pretentious to say that sort of stuff.
Maybe.
The only reason I can say it is that it's absolutely true and genuine. And it impresses me and surprises me as much as it probably does you. So what are they talking about and why? There's a few things. First of all, it's not a race. And we're usually smallish groups, so anything between 10 and 25. And I ride all the stages with the clients. And I think they quite easily understand what kind of drives me. And the fact that that is really a passion about riding in the mountains as something that is quite special. But it's even more special when you share it in a group of people. A lot of amateur cyclists, that they either have an experience of group cycling through sort of grand fondos and organized mass participation events, or through races, or through more commercial kind of cycling holidays. Quite often they'll be part of a bigger group, and the aim will be for you to have a nice day on the bike. And okay, you'll have to sweat a bit at times, but overall, they want you to be on a bit of a holiday and enjoy every moment of it. These events are not holidays, that's for sure, because we're all going to suffer. But it's that suffering and that sharing of the suffering that, first of all, creates amazingly strong bonds between people, because we all become very vulnerable after a while. We're all tired. We could probably do with a bit more sleep than we've been having. But we're also in a state of elation just by being remote and in enormous vistas or with enormous panoramas all around us. And, you know, I keep saying to people, you know, don't forget to look sideways. Don't always look down at the tarmac. Look up and look around you, because you may not be back here for a while. And it's just too good to miss. And I think by the sheer scale of the effort required and the kind of tone that I give to the event, people gradually leave their worries and their world behind them. And they get to this state, which I think we all kind of look for. And so it's so often it's so hard to find. And that is a state where you're just in the present moment. You're just involved, absorbed by what you're doing. And you have no time to think about anything else. And that is a very liberating thing. But it's also a time where if you've got problems to deal with within yourself, that's when you're going to have to deal with them, because, you know, the old demons are going to come out. And although we ride kind of socially, let's say, you know, we're not racing. So when we can, we do like to have time to ride side by side. Inevitably, when you've got a 15-mile climb to do, you are each going to spend time on your own. I mean, the next rider may only be 10 yards ahead of you, but each person will be in their own space trying to work out how they're going to deal with yet another climb. And I think that's where stuff happens.
It sounds like a moving meditation.
Well, it is. It is. I mean, I don't. People often say this stuff, and I don't like to come across as some kind of cycling guru.
I understand.
That's what it's about, because of where we are and because of what we do. You know, there's a lot of time to listen to the world. And there is something pretty special about it. Wherever you are in the world, if you've spent 2 hours on your bike to get from somewhere low to somewhere high, that is a special experience in itself. And it's bound to have an effect from you, whoever you are, whatever kind of person you are, when you're at the top of a mountain and you look around you. I mean, I think, you know, 90% of people are sensitive to some kind of special moment up there. And that's, you know, you don't have to get any deeper than that.
You talk about the rhythm of the roads and the road dance that you do. And
yeah,
that is sort of descriptive of what you're saying. So,
yeah,
I can imagine.
That's right. You know, the thing about the rhythm of the roads is all this has kind of come to me over the years. And, you know, I've been used to spending pretty much from sort of mid-May to mid-October on the road, either driving to and from events or riding events. Up until 2016, I used to ride the Tour de France every year. I've ridden that 7 times. managing a group. Sometimes I had up to 90 riders on the road. So that's 3 weeks on the road in a bubble. And my events are 10 days at a time, and I quite often do them pretty much back to back. So I end up spending a long time on getting to know what happens out there on the roads. And that's where you become just more and more sensitive and pick up on more and more things about what is it that becomes so obsessional and fascinates people. You know, it amazes me. And I always start my events thanking people so much for coming from all over the world. You know, the first trip this year, I've got 5 Russians, I've got 8 Americans, I've got 5 Australians, I've got a Brazilian, I've got 2 Scandinavians, you know, and these guys have obviously, let alone the money, they've taken a lot of time out of their lives to come and ride something. Okay, it's a pretty nice area, you know, I can understand why they want to come to the Apennini in Italy. But still, it's a pretty special thing to have all got all those people together to do one of these rides together.
Are there ever any women on your rides?
Yes, there are. Yeah. On that particular event I've been talking about, we've got 3. There is always a minority, you know, inevitably. But I have to say that there is just as high success rate amongst the women as there are against the men. And sometimes they can be amongst the strongest riders in the group. It's great. I don't need to have lots of them, but if I've got 1 or 2 ladies, that keeps all us blokes much more polite and civilized.
Having worked in a bike shop for many, many, many years, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's hilarious. Yes, we do keep you on your toes, right? Or at least.
Yeah, that's right. Really good. That's otherwise funny. It's just too much man talk, testosterone flying everywhere.
Something on your website reminds me that you're only going to do this for 4 more years. Is that true?
Yeah. So in 2022, I'll be 65. And I think, as I said earlier on about doing the 1,000 coals when I was 60, and I feel that, you know, I'm ready to say one day, okay, let's I think I've done this enough. And I think the other reason for doing the 1,000 coals was also because, you know, some people said to me, including my wife, obviously, why don't you just go a bit easier on yourself? And maybe you don't have to ride these anymore. Or maybe you just ride in the afternoons or, you know, ride one day and then have one day off. And that seems like a kind of a bit of a limp way of sort of stopping, you know, just like slowing down and just let the rust set in. And I'm not like that. So I think it has to be all or nothing. So then that's why I thought, actually, I'm just going to say, do this for a few more years and then that's it. Essentially, see, the thing is they're not really commercial events for an investor, for instance. And even for myself, you know, quite a lot of the sort of cycling work is more a choice of lifestyle than, you know, I should think, you know, that even running a shop, it's a lifestyle thing more than, you know, a choice of how am I going to earn a lot of money? Because you're not going to earn a lot of money.
That's right. We have a saying in the bicycle business that if you want to make $1 million, you have to start with $2 million. So I understand exactly.
I earn enough to pay the bills. I think the point being, I'm trying to say here is that I'm not sure, and who knows, I might find someone who comes on and says, I want the song calls to go on, I'm going to buy it, and you know, you just tell me what you want me to do and I'll keep the event alive. That might happen, but you know, I just quite like the idea of keeping the sort of the personal story side of it alive. And the story has an ending. It had a beginning and it's having an ending, and it's going to have an ending in 2022. And that's going to be a very special year because there'll be a lot of people who will want to be part of that. And then it'll be great memories, you know, and it's a very uncommercial approach, some would say, but it strikes a nice chord with me.
Oh, I like it.
And then who knows what I'll do after that.
I like it. So what we'll do is we'll come back to you in the last year and see what you're really thinking. Because I threatened to get out of the business and I retired, quote unquote, in 2012. And here we are still talking about bicycles, you know. So, yeah. Well, this has just been delightful. What do you do when you're not riding?
A lot. I've got a big garden. My wife and I love gardening. Mm. I'm renovating the fourth house in my life, which kind of means building it, really. We've got part of it that's going to become a place to stay. Here we call it a gîte, which is like a self-catering house, specifically designed for cyclists.
There are pictures of it, right? Isn't there something that's, about it on your website?
Yeah.
I saw it. I would love to come stay there. It's so beautiful.
Where we live, we chose this 10 years ago almost. We chose this. I mean, it's a beautiful area in the world, the Ardennes. It's very quiet. It's just north of Luxembourg. It's where the Liège-Bastogne-Liège race goes through. And very quiet, amazing variety of cycling. The whole area is beautiful, but we actually chose where we're living specifically with the idea of hosting people who want to come and cycle and showing them roads, either showing them literally, you know, riding together, or we just give them files. I talk about the end of the events in 2022, but I dearly hope that's not the end of my love for cycling or my ability to cycle. I'll just do it a little bit less, probably.
No, probably not. I've met people like you before, Phil. I know people like you. They don't ride less. They ride more. They just ride differently and maybe a little slower. So this,
I was going to say, you could be right.
Yeah, this little place is called, let me see if I pronounce it right, Le Petit Braquet?
Yeah, that loosely translated, that means the inner ring, because around here,
right,
you need an inner ring. Realistically, we're going to try and open it next year, to be honest, but I think we'll just keep it for when I finish the trips.
Well, it would be nice to have you post some more pictures as it gets further along.
Yeah, I'll do that for sure.
I mean, it's got to be just beautiful around there. Well, tell my listeners how they can find out more about you and about this amazing, I guess, challenge is what we call it, personal life challenge that you offer to people.
Yeah. So the website's the sans-cause-challenge.com. I post kind of regularly, maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks on Instagram, Sans-Cause Challenge, and Facebook as well. I should do more on social media, but I don't. But I do enough to keep the interest going.
Obviously, people find you.
They do, which is lucky. And I think just on the website thing, what was always interesting as a challenge in itself for me was to try and be realistic about what I do and what the event is, without scaring people too much. Because, you know, if you just put the statistics on paper, you know, if you asked your listeners what they have a look at the stats and do they think there's something this is they can do, you know, 90% of people say that's just ridiculous. And I love it. The riders I get the most satisfaction from on my events are the ones who I can see they are so scared when they arrive. They hardly sleep the first night before starting because they know they have really gone out of their comfort zone just by arriving at day one, let alone, you know, what's going to happen after that. And they make it. They get through. They might take a long time and they might, you know, get sort of arrive with 10 minutes before dinner starts, but they do it and they prove I relate to them so well, because when I did my 300 Cols ride on day three, I was in tears thinking, I've just taken on too much here. I'm not going to be able to do this. I was exhausted and something pulled me through those days. And I can see that happens to people on the events now. And it's a wonderful feeling, it's just a lovely personal warm feeling to think that actually I've got over this. I've managed my fears and I can do it. I've done it. It's a fantastic feeling.
Well, on that note, I hope people will go to the website and at least take a look around. Sans-Cols Challenge. It's Sans-Cols.
Yeah, which means 100 mountains.
Right, right. We need people to speak a little more French, don't you think? That'd be nice. Phil, this has just been delightful. Thank you so much for talking with me. I'm glad we got it together. We had all kinds of technical difficulties last week, but now we've got it. And I wish you a lot of luck. When is your birthday?
The 1st of August.
Well, happy birthday for this year. I probably won't talk to you. Maybe I'll remember and send you a little happy birthday sticker on your website. Have a great Sans-Cols Challenge for 2019.
Thank you very much, Diane.
All right. You take care.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Phil Dieker joined me from his home in Belgium. I guess if you're going to take one of his Sans-Cols challenges, you'd better think about it sooner than later. Or like me, you can look at all the beautiful photography on his website and watch his short film. And that might be just fulfilling enough. But if you are interested, log on to centcolchallenges.com. That's C-E-N-T-C-O-L-S challenges.com. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, Gary McKeaton will review Nige Tassel's new book, 8 Seconds, Greg LeMond, Laurent Fignon, and the epic tour of 1989. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. There have been many stories covering the 1989 epic edition of the Tour de France. Here is Gary McKeaton reviewing the newest one from Pegasus Books, 8 Seconds.
Thanks, Dan, for the opportunity to both read and review 3 Weeks in 8 Seconds, Greg LeMond, Laurent Fignon, and the Epic Tour de France of 1989 by Nige Tassel. The book is going to be published, I guess, in a few weeks, so now's a great time to let the listeners know all about it. Of course, the story is wrapped around LeMond and Fignon, and how those two competed, and how LeMond eventually won the Tour de France in 1989. LeMond, of course, is of great interest. He was the first American to win the Tour back in 1986. And the following year, early in the year, he was severely wounded in a very severe hunting accident. He was shot in the back, literally, by his brother-in-law. He went through a lot of surgeries, not only from the shooting, but appendicitis and some other complications. So frankly, he was a very, very ill human being for quite a long time in the time period 86, 87, and even 88. LeMond was a very, as many riders are at his level, very headstrong. And it was only 6 weeks after the shooting that he was back on a bike trying to ride again. He didn't want to give up on the sport. His competitive nature kept him moving. And it was early in 1989 when he was competing again professionally. And he made a decision to enter the Tour for 1989. The problem was nobody had a lot of faith in LeMond when you consider what he had gone through, the shooting, the other surgeries, the illnesses. His chances of competing, let alone winning the Tour, were almost nothing. You know, normally a winner a few years out is very well respected, very well paid, and has no trouble finding sponsors. But there was just exactly the opposite case here. So LeMond hunted around for a team, and a group of Belgians, a team called ADR, was kind of put together at the last minute before the Tour. They were not well funded, barely scraped enough money together for the entrance fee, according to Tassel. Many of the other riders on the team were, to put it bluntly, kind of weak. LeMond didn't really see that he was going to have the support from the other riders like a rider of his stature normally would. But that was his way to get into the Tour, to see what he could do. And, of course, in his mind, he wanted to compete and try to win. That was kind of the backdrop of how we got to the Tour in 1989. The nice thing about Tassel's book is it gives you enough of those details in the prologue so you can understand a little bit of the history. But it doesn't go into such excruciating detail about LeMond's family, how his father was a manager, and that sort of thing. Many other books have been written that can cover those details. Really, the way Tassel sets the stage, so to speak, for the 89 Tour really prepares the reader for what's going to happen. You know, aside from LeMond's history, there's a few other good details and things that Tassel throws in as well. He's actually got a chapter on the other contenders for the race that year. He doesn't simply list just the racers and their teams. He's obviously done quite a bit of research in each of their careers, their recent triumphs, their failures, their strengths, their weaknesses, and so on. Tassel has a knack for providing, adequate level of detail, but not such an excruciating level of detail that your eyes get heavy and you want to put the book down. And ultimately, it makes for a very engaging read. Between LeMond's history and the chapter on the contenders, when he does get into the start of the Tour, the reader is very well prepared for what's going to come forward. Another thing that he does, it's a little bit extra, I thought, was he has some coverage and some explanation about the management of the Tour, the race directors, how the operations work, the behind-the-scenes things, what makes the Tour tick. There's anecdotes about the spectators, some of their behavior, which is both good and bad, of course. There's talk about the business atmosphere and just starting to hint at some of the problems with the doping scandals, which became such a problem in the later years. Another technique of Tassel's, which adds tremendously to the veracity of the book, are direct quotes from many of the protagonists. I wasn't entirely clear if these were direct interviews. He talks about even talking to Fignon and others, saying that, 30 years on, this is what I remember and this is what I recollect. And I wasn't really clear whether Tassel actually interviewed these people or he was reading books that many of them had written. But he has a pretty extensive bibliography in the back that if anybody wants to dig any further into those details, they certainly have the capability of doing so. I think a good example of that is a chapter that's on Pedro Delgado, who was returning as a previous year's tour winner from 88. He was the odds-on favorite, of course, to win in 89, but the poor guy had tremendous problems at the start of the race. I won't go into those details here. You can read about him in the book. But you know, after those troubles, Fignon was one who liked to, I guess, get his digs in with Delgado. And one of Tassel's quotes was, he quotes Delgado speaking 30 years later. He says, "I like Fignon as a writer, but he's very disagreeable as a man." And I think that kind of foreshadows some of the events later on in the book. So the other thing I found was a little bit unexpected in the book. Tassel does go into a little bit of coverage about some of the other races, you know, such as Paris-Roubaix, the Tour d'Italia, or Paris-Nice. He doesn't really just bring them up to fill the pages. He uses them as background so the reader can better understand the tour riders and not just the big names. I enjoyed reading about the sprinters, the climbers, the domestiques, all of which are very important in most cases to successful teams. So that's a little bit about the background. And then, of course, the tour was covered very well itself. I suspect that Tassel watched many, many hours of race coverage from 89, you know, old videos and whatnot. He has many quotes from, you know, Paul Sherwin and Phil Liggett from BBC's Channel 4, their coverage from the race. And, you know, both those guys, of course, are legends. And their words carry not only tremendous weight, but they add a lot of color, which even non-racing fans would appreciate. Tassel also did a nice job with some of the race's technical details. You know, I'm not a bike racer by any means, never have been, never will be. But I enjoy reading not only what happened, but why it happened. Tassel goes into some of the technical aspects of the race. For example, why some riders would use solid wheels in the front or the back, how they're affected by on race day. Le Mans' use of aero bars, which of course were revolutionary at the time, and which some actually credit for those extra 8 seconds, the margin of victory at the final race day time trial. He also makes a good point about the lack of today's technology. You know, they didn't have race radios back then. And there was one particularly good anecdote about how Fignon's race director was trying to ride up behind him and give him some information that would have helped him move up or at least gain more time over Le Mans. And without radios, the only way to get in contact was to drive up into the peloton. But in one particular mountain stage, it was just too difficult to get the car moved forward. Fignon never got the information he needed, and perhaps that cost him some time. And as close as the victory was at the end, it could have cost him the race. Tassel weaves together a lot of different details, technical aspects, the business aspects, the other riders, the other teams. And one thing that really stuck with me after finishing the book is how well he lets us know that the human psyche is really important to the successful athlete, and how winners and losers attempt to twist the thoughts of the others, perhaps sowing doubt, blabbing hyperbole, whatever it takes to kind of get inside of the head of their competitors. Tassel does a nice job of detailing some of the racers' feelings before, during, and after the races, how they use their position in the peloton, the finish order, the stories they gave the media. For instance, one time Fignon was heard telling the French paper L'Equipe, "I have it in the bag." He didn't know if he had it in the bag, but he wanted the other riders to overhear that and get a little bit shook and, of course, question their own standing a little bit more. You know, racing, of course, it's obviously very a physical sport, but obviously there's some percentage that's physical and some percentage that's mental. Tassel helps make that all very clear. But in covering all these different stages over the 3 weeks and all these different aspects of the race, one thing I liked is when he came down to the very final stage, the famous time trial where Le Mans started out trailing by 50 seconds and ended up winning the race by 8. During that time trial, Tassel just played the narrative very straight. The chapter is really just a minute-by-minute description of Le Mans and then Fignon's races. The summary is gripping, and it's especially surprising that it is so exciting because everyone knows the ending. But nonetheless, it's a great way to end the story of the race proper. Tassel's book doesn't end at the end of the race. He does a nice job of going on for the next few months, how both Le Mans and Fignon competed against each other in some of the more minor races that year. But he also does a nice job of covering some highlights of the rest of Le Mans' career, some of the things that went into him choosing his next team, his much larger paychecks, and some other successes that he's had. So as happy as the ending of the book may be, you know, for the supporters and fans of Le Mans, one also has to be very sad and really feel for Fignon. His wife said that even though he lived in Paris, He never again set foot in the Champs-Élysées, where he lost the Tour in 89. It seemed like he was a tormented individual. People were frequently reminding him that he lost by 8 seconds, instead of reminding him that, hey, he had won two Tours and of course, many other races in a rather stellar career. Fignon contracted cancer and died at the age of 250, far, far too young. So in summary, I enjoyed the book quite a bit. I learned quite a bit about the race. I learned quite a bit about the riders, how the Tour works, and of course, all the details of things that went on both in front and behind the scenes in 1989.
My thanks to Gary for taking time to not only read 8 seconds, but also to review it for us. The book will be available from all the usual places April 2nd. I'd like to also thank Jennifer Carey and Paul Self from The Boo Bride. It steps off from either Orange County or San Diego on April 13th. And my thanks to Phil Deeker for a glimpse into his world of riding in the mountains of Europe. While it is something I will probably never do, his deep understanding and love for the sport is very much appreciated. We just plumb ran out of time to air my conversation with Red Kite Prayer's Patrick Brady this week. Patrick was the head judge at NABS March 15th through 17th, and next week we'll learn all about the process that the judges go through and why those who walked away with the winner's ribbons were chosen. So thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. Remember to stay safe out there, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.